Welcome to the 20th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. I'm trying to bring podcasts to educate my listeners, entertain my listeners, provide some new facts, support for going plant-based. Thank you for those of you that have given me some nice iTunes reviews. I appreciate that. For those that have listened and are listening tonight and enjoy the podcast, I'd encourage you and be very appreciative if you'd go to iTunes and leave me a positive five-star review. Since the last episode, I had a comment from Karen Smith Barron. She was surprised to find out that my patients aren't excited hearing about plant-based nutrition versus medications. And in the upcoming podcast, we'll talk more about this, but I think a lot of it has to do with why people go to the doctor versus go see an alternative medicine specialist or a nutritionist or a health educator or a lifestyle coach. I think those type of people are actually looking to change. Sometimes people come to see me, don't realize that they need to change or that by changing, they could actually help themselves. It's a long shot for some of them because maybe they're so ill that just changing their nutrition could actually change them. I think it's a surprise. Sometimes they never really even notice that anything was wrong with the way they are because if they look around, they look pretty much like their friends. They take similar medicine to their friends. So they don't really see that maybe things could be better by participating and possibly even changing their nutrition. I also got another email from a lady named I'm Edwin, and she talked about her sons who were in their late teens, early 20s, who were athletes, I think did some weightlifting, and she was concerned that they were eating more carbohydrates in the form of pastas and breads than maybe they should, and she wondered if it was okay. And, you know, basically, especially young guys that are really doing a lot of endurance athlete and their metabolism is so high as they're still growing the growth spurt in young men, 17 to 25 for the most part. So they need they require a tremendous amount of calories. All can, you know, in a healthy diet can certainly be obtained by a plant-based nutrition. And certainly, first and foremost, I would encourage them to get fruits and vegetables and colorful plates so that they get all their vitamins and nutrients, but certainly to fill them up and to get calories that, you know, whole wheat and whole grain pastas and breads are certainly fine, especially if there's not a weight issue. And, you know, even, you know, encouraged potatoes are a great thing for people that are doing endurance activities. Nothing really tastes better than a little boiled potato with, you know, even a little bit of salt when you're out on a long bike ride. So, you know, sweet potatoes, regular potatoes, whole grain pastas, breads are perfectly fine as long as you've got your nutrients from a large variety of greens and colorful fruits and vegetables. So that was a great question. And again, I encourage you know, more questions that I could address on the podcast. It would be great. Tonight's guest is Howard Jacobson. Howard is a PhD in education. Most of his career was in business in the marketing, internet marketing realms. But he's been a lifestyle coach. And done various programs. He was a plant-based guy for a while and kind of, like a lot of people, just slipped back into more of the standard American diet or let a lot of the standard American diet slip back into his nutrition. And then he read the China study and was blown away, and it awakened him to all the reasons why he had gone plant-based in the first place. And he actually wrote a review on Amazon and then was actually contacted by Dr. Campbell. And fast forward, and you'll hear more about it in the story, he co-authored Whole with Dr. Campbell. And this is an interesting book. It's kind of a sequel to the China study. And it kind of talks a little bit about, in a very non-dry way, about research and especially research in the nutrition realm, where it's really difficult to do isolated changes and look for outcomes and control it in an experimental area, whether it's trying to control what people eat and what they actually report they eat or what they reported anyway that they ate. Other environmental factors that come into play makes it very difficult. Even the methods of scientific study, when you ask a question and then you look for answers, sometimes it's more driven by pharmaceuticals these days or different treatment therapies as opposed to looking at disease. So the waters are somewhat muddied in plant in nutrition research in general. So it's a really good read. It's not overly scientific as far as it's people without a science background will find it interesting and eye-opening as far as how industry drives research, how media reports and misreports research and statistical nuances that really the research was never designed to look at anyway. And, you know, anybody that's went on Amazon and pulled up nutrition books and seen, you know, there's a zillion one ways to lose weight, and everybody seems to be an expert and everybody seems to have an opinion. But when you really look, even if it's referenced at all or where those references come from, it becomes a bit sketchy. So I've encouraged you to read this, if no other reason, just to educate yourself on how some of these conclusions get marketed and things kind of, you know, get wildly out of hand sometime, but that with a little bit of information goes viral, and before you know it, people are practicing crazy methods of nutrition with very little scientific merit. So without further ado, I'll go into the interview with Howard Jacobson. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Howard Jacobson. Dr. Jacobson is a co-author of Whole with T. Colin Campbell, and it's an honor to speak with you today. I heard you interviewed several different people on some of your plant-based journey, but I was a little bit, you're an educator, and you read the China study, and that really got you thinking and kind of was the hit over the head for you as far as your plant-based journey. Were you plant-based before that, and that just really drove it home, or how did that go?
Well, I had been plant-based in 1990 for about 2 or 3 years, and then I just sort of forgot about it because, I was 25, and any number of sins are hideable when you're in your 20s in terms of lifestyle and health. And so I went plant-based after reading Diet for a New America by John Robbins, which I think is that and the China study are the two books that I hear the most that influence people to change their diets. And then it kind of, you know, slid away, and I got busy with other stuff, and I kind of forgot, to be honest, you know, all of the good arguments in John Robbins' book. And then I was in a place where I was open in late 2004 when I read the China study, and it just brought everything back, brought it all home, and presented, of course, so much additional scientific evidence to support the health of a plant-based diet. And by that time, I was, approaching 40. So it had a much greater relevance.
Yes, the big 4-0 makes us all take a look. I actually also was a Diet for the New America that caught my eye for the first time, and I had never even. I remember vaguely there was a girl in our cardiac catheterization laboratory that said she was vegan, and she was kind of skinny, and I thought she was kind of crazy, and you know, I never really thought much about it until I read it, and then I became, like you say, very intrigued and couldn't ask her enough questions, and So it was it's amazing how many people cite that book. So at that point, so you're become more. What were you doing when you were 40 occupationally?
At that point, I was doing marketing. Mm-hmm. I'd been a school teacher for many years, and then I received a doctorate in health education, health studies, and public health. And I decided around the age of 30 that being a school teacher was kind of a lifelong journey of poverty that I didn't want to be in. So I started using my health background to try to get into corporate stuff. I thought I was originally going to just do, wellness consulting and stress management classes. And I quickly discovered I knew nothing about business. I didn't know how to get into a business, to make a cold call, to get myself known. And so I started studying business. And at that point, I was lucky enough in 2002 to stumble upon a really, really smart school of marketing that was using the internet. And this was after the dot-com bubble burst, and everybody thought that, well, the internet isn't real. And I found people for whom it was real and who understood marketing and understood human motivation and the mathematics of making offers and building businesses that work. And so I was in the forefront of an industry through sheer luck that allowed me to help a lot of people, who were just starting to build their internet businesses. So it was a great time, and that's kind of how I got away from the health stuff. The more opportunities there were in the business world, the more I studied, the more fascinated I became with marketing, with human behavior, with markets, with business building. And so that kind of was my career from around 2002 until, well, I'm still doing it. I'm transitioning and putting one foot firmly into the health world. But I still have that a marketing agency, and I do consulting and coaching.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet up with Dr. Campbell? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so he and I tell the story differently. He remembers meeting me at a VegSource conference in 2004, and I remember meeting him, but I remember being online with like 500 other people to shake his hand after he gave his talk about the China study research, and he remembered me somehow. I think we had a mutual friend, John Allen Mollenhauer, who introduced us, but given the attention he was getting and the celebrity to which he was afforded at that conference, I was certain that he had no idea who I was, and that he politely shook my hand and said, and we exchanged a few words, but I'm sure I meant nothing to him whatsoever. And I was just sort of awestruck. It was a good thing he didn't have the book out then, because I would just have like fallen over myself for an autograph. And the book came out, that was like October or November, and the book came out end of December, and I went to Barnes & Noble and bought one of the first copies available and read it again. And, I became like a lunatic. So it was all I could talk about. I became a very annoying and boring conversationalist. So I just wanted to share this information with everybody. And, nobody really wanted to hear it, which doesn't surprise me or in any way. I had to tone it down. But one of the things I did want to do was tell the world about it. So at that point, Amazon was, becoming a big deal. And so I went on Amazon and I wrote a review of the China study. And I have the date that I posted is still up there on the review. It was end of January. So it was approximately 5 weeks after the book was released. And to show you how little attention it had gotten, mine was the third review after 5 weeks. It's hard to imagine now. When Hole came out, we started getting dozens of reviews in the first hour that it was available. I'm not sure how all those people read it, but it was very kind of them. And, a good book that comes out with a splash these days we'll get, you know, dozens if not hundreds of reviews. But at that point, I was the third review after 5 weeks. And then the book started taking off, word of mouth. It was a magical publishing property. Nobody expected it to do particularly well in terms of numbers, but it sold over 1 million copies. And so it got more and more attention, more and more reviews, and it attracted the attention of folks from the Weston Price Foundation, who believe pretty much the opposite of what Dr. Campbell showed and discovered in his research. And so there were a lot of sort of negative reviews, ad hominem attacks, and the review page on Amazon became quite a battleground. And somehow my review, since it was one of the first, people rate the reviews in terms of helpfulness. So because it was one of the first, it got rated more than later ones, and it stayed at the top for months and months and months. And I think it's still like the number one or two review on Amazon if you scroll down, just by looking at the book. And after some months, I got a phone call from Dr. Campbell, who wanted to know, is this Howard Jacobson who wrote that very nice review? And I said, yeah. He says, well, I wanted to thank you because it keeps the others from being at the top, and it's really helping. So, after I kind of stopped, stammering and dribbling on the phone, I was able to have something of an intelligent conversation with them. And it turned out they lived in Ithaca, and we were going to be going up near Ithaca for the summer. So we went, and our families got together, and we visited for a bit, and we became friends. And that was really the origin.
That's very cool. I'm a great believer of everything works out for a reason, and it's your journey kind of came full circle there.
So. Yeah, it's ironic now looking back that this all came from something which I truly did not expect to receive any benefit from. It was I'm not like a selfless guy. I can look at what's in it for me as good as the next guy, but this was a truly selfless act in which I was expecting. I didn't think anyone was even going to see it. I just wanted to say something. So it's fun that the universe kind of made that review a pivotal moment in my life and career.
And then, fast forward just a little bit, and the writing of Whole. How did that change, I guess, your plant-based? Did it refine your diet? Did it drive home some things? Tell me how all that, came about.
Yeah, it sure did. And what it did was, the China study, the book, and the study itself had been the subject of a lot of criticism. And a lot of that criticism sounds good. Like, you look at, there's people who are writing with alternative data analyses of the raw data of the China study, which I never looked at. And there was this meme going around the internet, the China study has been debunked, that a lot of the low carb and the paleo folks we'll throw out. The minute someone mentions Colin Campbell, they kind of try to pull the rug out from under that person, saying, oh, didn't you hear the China study was debunked? And to a certain extent, the discourse sounds intelligent. It sounds plausible. It's from people. It's not from big pharma. It's from people who, share my sensibilities to some extent. And I realized I was not in the position to evaluate whether the China study was right or not. All I knew was that I liked Dr. Campbell. I thought he was a cool guy. It made a lot of sense. But there were other people that I also found interesting and cool, and they were saying the opposite. And I found myself unable to figure out who was right. It turned out to be that I was following the faith-based diet. Like, I like this guy better than I like that guy. And I found that very troubling. And so when Dr. Campbell approached me and said, do you want to work on this book? I've got this manuscript. I've been, working on it since 2007. And that was in December 2011, I think, when we began. So he'd been working on it for 4 years. And I had this hesitation, like, do I really believe this? Like, I believe it, but if that's not enough, like, I need to know that this is right. I don't want to write something that may end up not being right. And so the process of working on whole for me was really a process of understanding the research, the way research gets done, the way it gets reported, the way it gets misinterpreted, and the way it gets used by industry. And I realized that there's almost no relation between what we hear as consumers of health information and the actual studies. And I would come out. I'd be working in my little office, and I'd come out running, and I'd scare my family. I'd be, "You can't believe, you're not going to believe this!" And I'd find some other outrageous newspaper article that completely misrepresented a pretty good study, or a study that was so poorly done and obviously funded by the dairy board or the cattlemen's association. So, like, why would the New England Journal of Medicine even publish this crap? And so what I came to understand was that Dr. Campbell's distinction about holistic versus reductionist research really could explain most of my confusion. And then once I chose a side, once I said that looking at individual details out of context doesn't make for good science, but if you want to prove anything, you can do it by looking at enough details out of context, that's when I gained complete confidence in the message, the plant-based message, because now I was touching the research directly rather than just relying on someone else to interpret it for me.
Yeah, all my education has been in the science field. And, you know, as a young person, there's just so much knowledge to suck up. You're taught New England Journal of Medicine, the big journals, you know, people, you know, these are the big three, you know, in a certain field. You know, those are the ones, and these are the people. And you take a lot of information for granted until you actually have some, and it's a long time before you actually have some time to sit back and say, wait a minute, who is behind this? And the more you start to turn over the rocks, the more you find. And, it was quite upsetting to me as far as, you know, some of the things that I had, you know, believed over the years or taken for granted, at least this is a safe place to look, and it's not necessarily safe. It's kind of scary when you first come around to it. But certainly, you know, Doctor, if you spend any time listening to him and then looking to his research, you see he's the real deal.
Yeah, and you know, getting to know him also helps me understand a lot of the criticisms that's thrown at people like Dr. Campbell by industry are really just projections. So then, you know, one of the classic slurs of someone who is putting out a message that could harm an industry is, "Oh, that person, they're only doing it for the money." So, we were working on whole. You know, he was driving like a Celica from the '80s or something. Like this is not a guy who cares about money.
Well, yeah.
You know, living as honest as the day is long, whenever I pointed out some research that said maybe this contradicts something, he would look at it, he would go through it, you know, completely open-minded. And it's, you know, ironic that it's industry that is funding and promoting all these terrible studies and promoting bad media reporting and underwriting it and threatening to take away advertising if their line isn't, heated. They're the ones, you know, if you think like who has a vested money interest in putting out falsehoods, Dr. Campbell or Coca-Cola? Like it becomes ludicrous that these, large corporate interests would fund AstroTurf organizations that are supposedly looking out for our well-being and are just front groups.
Yeah, I was just pulling up some of the new guidelines and some of the, you know, beginning statements, and that's so carefully worded as far as, you know, Americans are obese and they don't eat enough vegetables and they should eat less fat and salt and sugar.
But, you know, so far I haven't read anything, you know, that says the meat word or the dairy word as far as, you know, that's the problem.
Right. Well, the lore is that, you know, that they, all the politicians learned their lesson in the 70s when McGovern came down against meat and dairy and was not reelected. And that everyone learned from that punishment.
Yeah, I think that certain people that are high political figures now that all of a sudden aren't so convinced about the plant-based diet may also be looking at some of those statistics. But anyway, so you write this book. I looked on your website. You know, you have a podcast as well, and it's very good. Plant Power and
Plant Yourself.
I'm sorry. I looked on your the website. It said bring about world peace, marketing, permaculture, and great food. You're interviewing some great people. What are you trying to do now? I would guess you want to spread this message the best that you can. It's not an easy message in the stream of, there's a lot of telling people, telling people what they want to hear sells books and sells products a lot better than, being straightforward sometimes. So, what's your plan now? Are you coaching people? Well, are people coming to you? How are you spreading this message?
Yeah, so I do have a coaching practice, and so I still have the business coaching. But one of the things that I found was that when I was coaching people on their business issues, especially CEOs, high performance employees, entrepreneurs, that it always came down to their body and their health was their only tool. Like everything they were going to accomplish in the world was going to be accomplished because of or in spite of their body, their energy, their mood, their ability to, get things done, convince people of things, write things. And so almost every single one of my clients over the last 5 or 6 years, we focused on their health. And so I just started, developing a whole set of tools for actually helping people. So once somebody believes, okay, I read the China study, I've seen forks over knives, I'm convinced, now I want to do it, that's when people get into trouble. So I'm not really interested in trying to convince anyone of anything. What I'm doing right now is taking people who are already interested in improving their health, and they simply don't know what to do, or they've discovered what to do, but they don't know how to get it into their lives. And so I work with people on an individual and group basis to help them make those shifts easily and, equally importantly, joyfully.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. So you're working mainly in the business sect, or I would guess a fairly early 40s, 50s type population?
It varies. I've actually opened up my practice to people who are not just in the business world. So I have some programs that are much, easier for ordinary civilians to afford as opposed to, the kind of high-end business coaching that I've been doing. It really varies. So one of the truisms is that people come for help open-minded when they're sick. So it's unfortunate that it takes, a scare or a small stroke or elevated cholesterol and they're going on various drugs to get people awake. The good news is, as the plant-based diet is really effective at reversing a lot of those issues. So in fact, it's often, it's almost always not too late to reverse decades of self-abuse in terms of diet and lifestyle. I work with families. I work with older people in their 60s and 70s who really, don't want to look forward to the last decades of their lives infirm and on drug cocktails. So, you know, people come at different stages for different reasons. And I do have just business clients for whom, you know, we just experiment. I don't, if someone comes to me to help them in their career or to grow their business, I'm not necessarily going to push a plant-based diet on them. I won't insist. If they want to try other things, one of the things we do is we look at how they feel, we look at their numbers, and I trust that people's bodies are wiser than they are, and that if you just simply tune into the awareness of what you're eating, when you're eating, how you're eating, that you'll arrive at something close to a plant-based diet, if not a pretty pure form of it over time.
Yeah, that's you know, really very interesting. One thing that you just said, and then, you know, when we spoke briefly last week, I think you were a little surprised when people come to me and they are surprised when I bring up the plant-based diet. And then that what you just said was people come to you looking, when they've had a health scare, they're ready to change. And I wonder if some of that difference is basically who you're looking at. When you look to the medical community, if you're one, I find some people don't realize how bad they feel, and they have, you know, if you go to the typical, you know, high school basketball or football game and look around at the people that, you know, say have high school kids or teenage kids in the stand, they pretty much look alike, but not a lot of those people are really healthy. Especially in their 40s and 50s. But again, it's hard to see that you're not, it's just not a natural aging process. So, you know, you're starting to take up golf and down here, ride in a golf cart, you know, go out to dinner, you have a little bit more means. And so it becomes that kind of a lifestyle that everybody has, as opposed to maybe when they come to see me, it's more like I'm really sick and I need to get a quick fix because I don't feel good. And this needs to get, we need to turn this around quickly, as opposed to maybe when they seek you out, they've had some time to think of it and do some research on their own and say, well, hey, maybe I don't want that path.
Right. Well, I think part of the difference is that people come to each of us with a different set of expectations.
Yeah.
Right? So they're surprised. I have friends who don't really know me as a business person. You know, they know me casually from you know, local community stuff. And you know, there's not to toot my own horn, but I have business books that I've written. I've given talks and done consulting internationally. And you know, so there's people out there who think I'm pretty smart, but not my friends. You know what I mean? Not sort of local folks. Or if, you know, so if they came to me and we're chatting about business and I started giving them like my best stuff, they wouldn't even necessarily hear it. Like, oh, that's Howard. What the hell did he know? You know. So if people see you, I guess as a cardiologist, they already have a very clear picture of what a cardiologist does. You know, gives them drugs, does surgery, watches them here. You know, whatever they think your specialty is, that's what they're going to go to you for. And it'll be all sorts of cognitive dissonance if they're not expecting what you're going to tell them.
Yeah, I'm certainly finding that out. And of course, you know, you add to it a sea of other thinking, and, you know, I'm kind of the lone person that approaches things this way. So it, you know, makes it even a little bit more shocking. It's been quite a journey for me so far, in that I'm so torn between the two worlds. You know, the people that are on board and the plant-based people, and you hear the interviews and, you know, doctors don't have any education. I heard your interview with Dr. Esselstyn, and, you know, you had the same conversation. You know, we aren't given any nutrition information in medical school or in residency, only, you know, how to do intravenous treatment to the most sick people until they can take medicine, and then, you know, then we give them their pork chop back. You know, so most of us don't have, you know, any knowledge in that, and unless you pursue it on your own, you don't get it. But I don't think that gives us a pass not to learn it, because, you know, we're supposed to continue our medical education, you know, for wherever it leads to. And so, you know, I do think that, you know, just because we didn't get it in medical school, most of your knowledge probably occurs after medical school. So it's kind of up to the individual to, you know, continue their education in whatever realm it needs to be taken.
Right. The other thing you and I talked about offline is the fact that, for, not just you, but for many health professionals, that there's a huge disincentive to learn that there's a better way to do things. Right? Because, you know, a doctor watches Forks Over Knives and all of a sudden decides, wow, there's a better way to practice medicine, we don't have a model for that person to make any money doing it. What are you going to, you know, you're going to give up your weekends and your evenings, and you're not going to make any money. The insurance company isn't going to pay for those patient gatherings. There's, you know, we need a wholesale systemic change in how we do healthcare so that people who actually help us get better get rewarded for it.
Right. Yeah. You need to. I don't know if it was Dr. Esselstyn or somebody else that I heard recently, but you need to, just like anybody else, be paid on by outcomes, and not just outcomes. Did you order 20,000 tests? But did you actually make somebody live longer or live better? You know, and again, it's kind of hard to quantify that, but you know, something needs to change. I mean, you know, there's essentially no support, you know, in a hospital environment. It's much easier to admit somebody for a gastric bypass than it is for, you know, and nutritional education, and take people off their medications. I mean, I absolutely no support, and actually run the other direction from me, hospital staffs, hospital administrators. They want nothing of it. And, you know, it is crazy to the point where I don't, you know, I've, you know, even given up as far as, you know, I talk to the patients while they're there, but basically say, when you get to my office in a week or two, then the real work starts, because there's just nowhere to go in a hospital setting. So
right.
it's very frustrating, but, yeah, I think there, you know, there may be some fear, but you know, I was kind of thinking of it as, it's like a people talk about the animal agricultural business, and some people will bring up the, well, if everybody stopped eating cows today, what will we do with all the cows? And you know, and it's kind of like that in the medical industry. People are afraid. It's like, well, if everybody stopped needing bypasses and having high blood pressure, then you know, what would we do? Or if everybody adopted a plant-based diet, what would we do if everybody, but you know, the reality of it is it would take a long time if everybody were 100% plant-based to get everybody through these stages and get them healthy and get those people that were beyond help, you know, but it's that.
Right. Well, what would happen if everyone tried to sit in the same seat at the movie theater?
Right. Yeah.
You know, well, that's not a very interesting question, you know, to anyone who's reality based.
Exactly. You know, but that's kind of where it comes back to, you know. So I think it's certainly a very, very interesting question. But, you know, I do think that, you know, I feel a responsibility as a physician now to spread this message and to try to, you know, get my patients to adopt a more healthy lifestyle. And part of this podcast is trying to learn from other people, you know, the approach. Dr. Esselstyn, you know, his approach with taking time with people, we're trying to use some of his approaches. You know, he carries that fatherly figure that I don't know anybody that wouldn't do what he would say, you know, but,
yeah.
You know, but, you know, it's quite a niche, and it's quite an education process. To one, you know, the shock and awe of presenting this information to people when they walk in your door, and not offending them, and you know, you know, and having them open up to it. You know, it takes several visits. And, you know, the class, I'm trying to do a class in the office, and I think, you know, more and more people by the third or fourth class tend to open up more and, you know, start to get some positive feedback from it, you know, and it's promising. But it's a bit of a struggle in this setting. And, you know, again, getting the two worlds to meet is, I think, the challenge.
Yep. We're living in exciting times.
Yeah. I think it's all good. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of hope that there's an alternative to, you know, being sick and on medications for the rest of your life. Tell me about your permaculture. Is that a hobby as far as your gardening or?
Well, it is, but it's also an integral part of my lifestyle. And I think it needs to be an integral part of any effort to make humans healthier. So one of the things that I came to as a result of working on Whole was that I'm always looking for the next concentric circle out that I haven't included yet, that everything is part of a bigger system than I know, and we need to move to the bigger systems. So, you know, if we aren't growing our own food, and if we aren't in touch with our own soil, and we aren't in touch with nature, I don't think it's possible to have a civilization that's well and happy based on industrialized agriculture, based on the kind of pesticides and GMOs that big companies are trying to foist upon us. I don't think it's possible to even, you know, thrive on a 100% plant-based diet if it means that people on the other side of the world are dying from pesticides that are sprayed on the crops that we end up eating, that, you know, that migrant farm workers are treated terribly, that water supplies for indigenous populations are being hijacked to grow our mache and fennel and radicchio. I don't think that ultimately anything that hurts another can make us well. And so I see permaculture, which is, you know, defined as sort of a permanent agriculture, but really a sustainable culture. You know, we think of like sustainability as kind of this hippie word. All it means is like, as a civilization, we're not going to die out anytime soon, which I think most people would think is a pretty good idea. So to me, it's about looking at health from a global biological perspective, and empowering people to be in touch with the natural processes that feed us. You know, that food, we talk about food in the plant-based community as a, you know, just something we put in our mouths. And when you think about it, food is really our interface with the world. It's how the world becomes us. And I think it's very important for us to start feeling like we can be self-reliant. We don't have to rely on giant corporations to feed us.
Yeah, that's, I think that, you know, looking back, I grew up and my grandparents had a big garden. My parents had a garden. And that was a lot of my happy memories as far as, you know, we ate what came out of the garden and that's what sustained us. I do think that we're missing that as a culture. I think more and more people are doing it. You know, here in Florida, it makes it a little easier. You know, there's some organic farms around and, you know, you can grow some things in your backyard. And I think more and more people are having, you know, some gardening into organic farming and things like that. And I think that's a very, you know, very good idea. And then I guess and circle that back in, I think getting our children in the school system to kind of connect those dots as well and not just think of food as being a wrap or a breakfast sandwich when they go into school or the pizza and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think that the education in our school system is so, it needs to be addressed as well.
Right. I think, you know, that all of the problems of our civilization are interconnected, and at some level they're all based on how we do food. Like every civilization has similarities and differences, but you can really categorize civilizations based on how they get their food. And, you know, you could have hunter-gatherers, you can have giant agricultural societies, you can have pastoral nomads, you can have horticulturalists, and each of those initial setups determines almost everything about the society. And we have created a sort of a megalithic industrial agricultural society, and anyone who's followed the plant-based world for a while knows the state of factory farming. The basic assumption of our civilization is that the earth is ours for the taking, and other creatures are resources for us to take, and the fields are simply bare soil into which we pour fertilizers and pesticides and put down modified seeds. And there's no sense of the sacred. There's no sense that we belong to this. And as long as we try to be master and commander over all this instead of equal partners, we're gonna get sick.
Very, very well said. Networking in the health industry. Are you doing a little bit of that now? We talked about. Is that just starting as far as getting like-minded people together?
Yeah, I think it's very important because, you know, holistic health needs to be holistic. Holistic health is not just, you know, let's eat more salad. Holistic health is the entirety of, you know, all the facets of human beings, from our skeletons to our muscles to our emotions to our digestive systems to our immune systems to our reproductive systems. So, you know, they're all interlinked. So I think the more we can do evidence-based treatment and refer back and forth and be in connection, the more we're going to treat people as whole human beings and not just as, you know, the stent in room 200. So I'm partnering with the Wellness Forum Healthcare Network. I'm out of Columbus, Ohio. So I feel really good about the fact that if one of my coaching clients or consulting clients, health consulting clients, comes to me with something that a plant-based diet can't help, or you know, the type of exercise I can show them, or the type of lifestyle design that I'm qualified to help them with, you know, if they're on psychiatric meds, I'm not going to take them off of those. I need to be connected to psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers or those who have experience and knowledge to get people off of those meds. Because you know, if you're on Butrin or Zoloft for too long, you'll never lose the weight. So I'm a big believer in the kind of networking with, you know, with other parts of the medical community that also get it. So the plant-based community gets diet right, and most of the medical community gets diet wrong. Well, guess what? The same is true in just every other type of medicine. There's the mainstream, and then there's the small group of people who actually follow the evidence and get it right. So we need to create a network of those people who really care for evidence and results to start working together to get people well.
Fantastic. Well, you know, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. You're a wealth of information, and you know, like I said, you're a podcaster. You've interviewed some very, very interesting people. And it gives a lot of perspective, not only to the plant-based world, but just how we live in this world in general. So I appreciate you taking time to speak with me.
Well, it's a pleasure. You know better than anyone how much fun it is to do a podcast and get to speak to amazing people. So this is like the best-kept secret of a happy, intelligent life, is to just get a podcast and get people to come on and explain their worlds to us.
I know. I call people or email them, and they email me back, and I'm so surprised. And I'm like you. I run through the room saying, guess who just emailed me? Guess who just emailed me? And then I can't, you know, then we do the podcast, and he's like, oh, I can't wait for this one to come up to see what people think, you know? And it's... I felt like, you know, it's my little glimpse into the back room of this is how it really works. And these are the secrets, and you get to share them with everybody else. So it's great fun. It's great learning for me, and I hope others. And, you know, I'll look forward to continuing to follow your path along the way through your podcast, and I'm sure more books in the future. And, you know, good luck to you. And I hope to keep following you.
Right on, anytime. And you and your podcast also go from strength to strength. There's no end to what we have to share, and no end to the need for it.
All right. Well, you have a good afternoon, and I hope the sun is shining in North Carolina.
It is. Now I have to go out and defrost the pipes, because while we were on, my wife came and made a motion that we have no water in our house. So I'm going to go out and see if I can figure out what's going on with that with her.
Well, good luck for a hot shower later tonight, then. All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Howard Jacobson. It's nice to speak with people so positive and so many great ideas for the future, and it kind of makes you think everything's going to be okay. Before I exit tonight, I thought I would share with you a recipe that my mother came up with from scratch this evening that was very good, so I'll share with my dinner tonight. She did Swiss chard. She just steams it and put a little balsamic vinegar on it. We had some butter beans, again, just warmed up. But the main dish was a combination of eggplant and chopped. She actually used, there's this Asian spinach that we get in our farmer's basket from the organic co-op each week, but you could use celery. So it was chopped eggplant, the chopped spinach, and that was actually the stalks that she used. And they're a little bit celery-like, kind of between a celery and a cabbage. Anyway, she chopped those up, added that to rice, and some crushed tomatoes. A few whole wheat breadcrumbs and a little bit of hot sauce, and bake that, and it was very, very tasty. So I'd recommend that as a dinner. Oh, and we also had a cucumber and tomato and onion salad. So it was a great dinner. I'd highly recommend that. Yesterday I actually made a spice cake from the vegan baking cookbook from Colleen Patrick Goudreau. Instead of using oil, I just used some flaxseed and a mashed up ripe banana, and it turned out great. It was moist, and so that was another alternative. I cut the sugar that was required in about half and used some dates instead. So that turned out as good as well. So just a little tidbit for a recipe if you haven't tried something along those lines. You know, my mom, you know, I've said it before, she said if she were younger, she'd do a vegan restaurant, because she's having so much fun creating plant-based, no-oil recipes, and she does quite a good job. So if you have any questions, topics that you'd like to discuss, you can reach me at jamiedelaney@gmail.com. And for now, stay plant strong and run long.